Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt and taxes and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, with a love of fantasy books and funk, and a hatred of running more than 3 miles, Dave Denniston.
My name is Dave Denniston, your host, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, welcome back to our monthly fireside chat here with a physician to get to know their journey, their joys, their struggles with finances and outside of finances. And this show, you guys, I'm changing it a little bit. It's not always going to be about actionable content. It is, however, a chance for you to see behind the curtains, to walk in another person's shoes and experience their lives. And our next guest, he responded to an email I sent out in regards to looking for people for this new kind of show, and he is generous enough to share with us his journey and his wisdom. He is a pediatrician. However, I'm guessing he hasn't always wanted to be a doctor. He got his undergraduate at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and then took classes in theology at the Lutheran School of Theology. So that's interesting. We'll find out about that. He took a couple of years off and then pursued becoming a DO and a doctor. And here we are years later. He shared with me that he is just finishing the steps of a buyout to a regional medical corporation. So I can't wait to hear about this journey. Please help me welcome Dr. Gary Sneed. Welcome, Gary.
Welcome, Dave. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, this is going to be great. So first, tell us a bit about you. Where did you grow up?
Well, I was an Army brat, and my dad is a career Army officer, West Point grad in artillery and air defense. We moved around every 2 to 4 years, born in El Paso, lived in St. Cloud, Minnesota, Seoul, Korea, Minnetonka, Minnesota, and Hampton, Virginia.
You've been all over the place, my goodness.
My older brother was born in Frankfurt, Germany, and actually around Stuttgart, before they came back over to have me, and then my sister was born in St. Cloud. My brother lives down in Fort Lauderdale now, and my sister's out in Richmond, Virginia area.
So all of you are all over the place. I mean, how did that influence you, you know, in terms of being in the Army? Did you want to be in the military at one point yourself, or what was that like?
I thought about it, and when I was in medical school looking to get scholarship funding applied, but at that time the military was tightening down on who they were taking instead of opening up, and so they were real strict about the physical requirements, and I just wasn't up to being able to bench press 120 pounds at that time. So.
Oh, man. You asked me to bench press today. I like to work out, but I don't bench anymore. Yeah. So that might be a little hard. So as you grew up, did you want to be in medicine always, or what was that like?
Well, I didn't have any real particular plan early on, but then when I was on the debate team in high school, started thinking about law school. And I had an uncle that was a lawyer and another uncle that was a orthopedic surgeon in Minneapolis area. And thinking more about law and politics. And then once I got to college, my first biology honors professor had taught at University of Virginia in the medical school and knew about osteopathic medicine. And I found that as a way to unite my mind, my heart, and my hands and make it all fit to work toward a profession for the future.
Well, and I did mention in the intro that you got your undergrad in Virginia, and then you took classes in theology later on. So were you thinking you wanted to be a pastor at some point back in the past, or what was that like?
But as a Christian, knowing that I'd be in a professional field, I'd want to be able to speak professionally about it. And so I figured if I got some systematic theology and New Testament Greek and contemporary theology classes and preaching, I was able to be able to present and discuss and work with others with my faith in a more intellectually acceptable way so that I'd be on their playing field instead of just trying to preach at them. I'd be able to talk with them.
That's a good skill. A lot of pastors could use that course, I think.
Yeah. And one of the things I took was a clinical pastoral education, which is basically being a pastor at a hospital setting. The CPE program, you work as a team of theology students, seminary students, as spiritual care providers at a hospital setting. And the hospital we were at Rush St. Luke's in Chicago, they had a documentation requirement that the staff had to call us on anytime there was a death. And so we would come in and help perform spiritual support and care for those that were working through that loss of a family member. And that helped me see that end of care, that end of life, and build my compassion as a physician, and as my plans went to be developed as a physician to keep that compassion, that sensitivity to that end of life and all the family needs that come with that. And then after that, I worked for 2 years in Minnesota as a certified nursing assistant, kind of learning the base of elder care and just the nitty-gritty, dirty, wipe the butts, clean the bedpans, and shower and bathe and feed people and listen to their stories. And some of them had great stories. I had one gentleman that had worked with Wild Bill Hickok, breaking horses for him as a teenager. Reaching back through a century of history to see something come alive again was pretty cool.
That's amazing. What a cool journey. And so did you know that you wanted to go to medical school during that whole time that you were in theology?
Yep.
And then
And the purpose of theology, like I was saying, was just so that I could be on kind of a intellectually strong position as well as a faith-built position to be able to talk with my colleagues and stand up for my faith in that setting.
How wonderful. Wow. That's really, really neat. So today, medical school costs so much, and obviously you went to a few different schools. So I'd like to know, you know, was debt part of that journey for you at all? Or were you able to eliminate it pretty quickly? What was that like?
That was a big deal. And part of that was my own fault, and we'll get into that. But I was, as a state resident in Minnesota at the time, we had a scholarship program that would pay the difference in tuition at a private school in Kirksville, Missouri, the College of Osteopathic Medicine, versus the University of Minnesota's medical school. So that saved me about $7,000 a year in tuition out of $14,000. So this was back in 1983 to 87, so it was a little bit cheaper than it is now. But even with that, there were living expenses, loans, and books, and fees, and building a family. I met my wife the year before I got into medical school and had a child at the end of the second year, and or end of the first year. I was just a few months old in the second year when we started doing clinical rotations, and then another child during internship and another one during residency, so the family needs kept building. And
yes.
So when I graduated, it was about $37,000 to $40,000 in debt, but because of the delay in paying it off over time, the interest went ahead of that, and by the time I was set in practice, I had debt of over $117,000.
Well, I got to imagine if going to medical school then, I mean, interest rates in the early 80s were like 15%.
Mm-hmm. Some of the state loans I had were a little bit lower, and those were deferred interest until graduation. But the HEAL loans, health education assistance loans at the time, started accruing interest as soon as we got the money and had to use that to pay the bulk of the tuition and fees every year. And so that built up very fast, and because I didn't maintain a budget, that's one of the other questions you asked about the good financial advice I had was to budget myself and plan and save aside. But I didn't follow that advice, even though I knew it was good advice all the time. And so sometimes we'd get underwater and have to put in a deferment on the HEAL loan payback, and they'd give me a six-month grace period, but of course they're still accumulating interest, so I'm paying interest on interest on interest eventually.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
So
and
do
you remember what those rates were? You know, were they 10%, 12%?
14 to 15%, I think, on the HEAL loans.
And were you able to refinance those along the way? Because, of course, as time went on.
Yeah, once I got into practice, we kind of refinanced it all and paid some of it down with a second mortgage kind of a deal, but still had a lot to pay. It took me until about 8 years ago to pay off the last of that with the bonus that we were provided through our building partnership program. So my real estate income is actually paid for more stuff than my medical income to get that debt paid back down. So it was a good step that the group here had set up the building partnership as well as the professional association. And at the time I joined, the buy-in was pretty low. And so I was able to accrue a significant value in that through the years. You know, one of the interesting questions you asked about what did my childhood smell like, and with all that travel all around the world, it was the smell of the dust in the air as the rain was going to come up here in the upper Midwest, and the kimchi in Korea, and the bicycle chain grease as I learned to ride my bike and fix the bike and pull my pants out of the bike chain as it would get caught in there every once in a while. We didn't have leg clips at that time. I guess we hadn't thought of that.
Well, I got to imagine growing up in all the places you did, I mean, that had to make it a little easier as you did all the transitions that everyone has to do, you know, going to medical school and then moving someplace else for residency and then perhaps moving someplace else different for going to the practice.
The transitions have been what my life had all been about, and we moved around. And even in the third and fourth year of medical school, my clinical rotations, we ended up in 13 different sites from coast to coast. And that was just kind of just a compacted version of what I've done all my life. So it was really weird to settle into Minnesota here and stay since 91, only moving once in 1999 from the south end of town to the north end of town.
Well, it sounds like you came back here a few times because you said you were in Minnetonka and St. Cloud, where you're at now. So it was the one place where you came back to a few times.
It's the only place I lived more than once and the only place I lived more than 4 years in a row. So it feels more like home than anywhere else. So.
And what do you make of today, Gary, with the all the young physicians? I see so many coming out with $250,000, $300,000 of debt as they transition to residency. What do you make of that?
That's overwhelming. It's hard to imagine that you would have to deal with that much debt. Now, balance that with starting salary when I came to the practice was estimated to be $60,000 to $70,000 for most people, and now it's $150,000 to $160,000 in some practice settings. So there's been some inflation on both ends of that. The debt's bigger, but the payback's a little bit bigger. But I think the debt's been growing faster than the payback in the last few years. The reimbursement rates and support for a reasonable income for all the time and effort you put into medicine has gone down quite a bit. So it's tough, and you almost have to plan, you know. I mean, one of the smartest people in my class was somebody that was really interested in hands-on work and millwork and machining and was really good with automobile stuff, and so he's been building and re-engineering replacement automobile parts for particularly classic cars, and he used that to help pay back his debt before he graduated and all along the way, and that's actually, as a hobby, actually has ended up paying for more than what he ever did for the other. We had another classmate that was a full-time large animal vet and kept his practice open weekends and summers and on breaks through medical school, and that helped cover his costs so that he was able to manage things afterwards. And unfortunately, his wife got breast cancer and passed away a few years after graduation, but he had the funds to try to help kind of get through that and not feel like finances were a burden as much as just the emotional loss.
Wow. So your fellow colleagues did a lot of different things to try and get out of the debt trap. And what do you think, if you were sitting with a first-year resident, you know, and you were to tell them about your life and what they think you could learn from it, what do you think is one piece of advice you would tell them?
The biggest thing is to learn to work with a team, both in your personal life and family life, as well as in your professional life and with your financial planning and business planning. Don't try to do it alone. Don't try to do medicine alone. And learn to ask for help and learn to save and enjoy your family time. Have a hobby so you're not just surrounded all the time with just medicine and a feeling of work pressure. But keep aware of your goal and be able to stand up for yourself when you know you need to, and instead of just letting somebody tell you what to do all the time. But always recheck, like, the answers to the questions you've been asking me. You know, why are you a doctor? What did you plan? What's been important for you? Keep revisiting that. Don't lose touch of that.
Great advice.
There's many options on ways to actually do medicine and the art of medicine too, so stay open-minded. Sometimes you get so tracked in, well, this is what I learned, or this is what this guy taught me, and that's what he remembers being taught by somebody else 20 years before that. And you can get into a trap of teaching 60-year-old medicine just because that's what you heard, instead of being open to what somebody else has to offer or something new you can think of on your own.
And so you found yourself kind of revisiting that, it sounds like, for you.
Yep. Yeah, and over the last couple of years, I've been kind of opening up again, basically with my osteopathic philosophy of holistic care and the importance of trying to treat the whole person, looking at different ways of doing functional medicine and naturopathic and homeopathic and how to kind of incorporate all of that where it makes sense and where it can work instead of just because. And that's been fun.
Tell me more about that. You know, why that change? You know, what did it look like before and what is it looking like now?
Well, I'd supported it in the past, but functional medicine itself has gotten to be a lot more active. There's a lot more people doing it and promoting the science behind it of understanding how all the different organs of the body and the immune system and all the different parts of us genetically and phenotypically work together to provide either a dis-ease or a work back toward ease, a health. And as I've had to relook at the way our practice has been going, the way my practice is, I don't want to just get trapped in a cookie-cutter pattern of, well, we're trying to follow this protocol and this community practice measure and this practice guideline that somebody else invented, or make it all fit into a code that somebody says has to be ICD-10. I want to do people medicine and take care of people and let the rest of it take care of itself.
Well, that's why you went to medical school, right? I mean, it was this care and compassion for people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And as you're looking back, you know, you think about your journey, and you mentioned earlier budgeting was something mm-hmm. that's like, I should do this, but it's just something that I couldn't get myself to do. And outside of that budgeting initially, if you would pass on, you know, here's a pitfall I made, I think other doctors could learn from. What do you think that looks like for you? What's been some of your biggest financial mistake or mistakes?
Well, the biggest ones are spending money before I had it or spending it in two different ways, and part of that's my ADHD. Sometimes I would kind of lose focus and lose track, and I'd think I'd have the money, and I'd want to spend it on this impulsively and then realize, well, there's another need over here. And as a family, my wife had her ideas, the kids had their ideas of what we wanted, and so you kind of get split up. And in a sense, I had the mentality through medical school and early residency of always being impoverished, that, well, any money I got, I can spend because I've suffered so much and had to give up so much and pay so much in debt that I owe myself this. And that mindset hasn't helped. It's now I try to look at what's going to work for me and what's reasonable within the funds I have. And Dave Ramsey's teaching with the Financial Peace University and the kind of envelope system of budgeting makes a lot of sense, that every dollar you've earned already has an ownership place to be where it's designed to be spent. And I didn't always think of it that way. I was like, well, I have all this money and I can spend whatever I think of, instead of there's already needs for all the utilities and the house and the cars and the family and what I want to give out and what I want to save for later. And if that all has a home, it's kind of like medicine. It all has a place to be. It all has its own pigeonhole. Then I can't just grab it and run with it somewhere else.
Yes. You know, I have a name for that condition.
Uh-huh.
It's the bright, shiny object syndrome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. and my kids, they have the ADOS. I have AD. I have attention deficit. Oh, shiny. So they get so distracted.
Squirrel.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me more about that.
Well, you know, I think, and I see this across many, many places. I've had people that I've worked with that I think of where they see something, they get really excited about it, and they go and spend a whole bunch of money. And this could be a car. This could even be for a business reason. Uh-huh. And, you know, I think about physicians, you know, it could be the newest and latest X-ray or technology. You get super excited about it. And you go out and acquire it, and then next thing you know, it's collecting dust, and you're moving on to the next bright, shiny object. And I've seen for many physicians, this tends to hold them back, whether it's in medicine or in their personal lives.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I love to give, and so sometimes I give or share the money and think, well, I'm sacrificing and I'm giving it away to somebody else, but I really don't have the money to give because it's already been in the true budget saved and set aside for a different purpose. And I'm trying to always repurpose stuff without really thinking it through.
Mm. That's good. That's really, really good.
All right. Well, let's take a pause here for a second and go to our commercial break. Well, if you are like most members of my audience, you are committed to being an amazing doctor and succeeding at life. But the truth is, you have never received financial training during medical school, and you struggle with enough time to do it all. And maybe you even made a few mistakes along the way. And that's exactly why I wrote my book, 10 Critical Mistakes Doctors Make with Their Money, and the brand new ebook, 5 Steps to Overcome Common Physician Financial Mistakes. As a matter of fact, you can't buy 5 Steps to Overcome, but you can get the entire ebook for free by subscribing to my free email newsletter at www.drfreedompodcast.com. My email newsletter lets you know once or twice a month whenever I posted fresh content to my podcast, so you don't always have to visit my podcast website. Plus, my newsletter subscribers, they get a first crack at exclusive offers and lots of free stuff. You can get the whole copy of 10 Critical Mistakes and your free copy of 5 Steps to Overcome Common Physician Financial Mistakes ebook by visiting drfreedompodcast.com and enter the form on the page.
So do you think, you know, has this affected you in terms of your retirement and where you want to retire, or do you think you've built up enough that you can overcome these mistakes?
Well, that's a good question. I think it was more of a struggle before of wrestling with, well, why do they keep asking for my money and why can't I just do this? But, of course, I don't know what I'm doing, and so maybe I'll just leave it alone. But realizing, talking to my colleagues, their profiles were growing a little bit better. Their portfolios were improving, and I wasn't. And I realized I've got to let it go. And part of that was in the family, and, you know, hadn't paid off all of my school debt yet, so we were still struggling with that, realizing I can't always stay in this poverty mindset. I've got to just realize we've got to get into a positive mindset of promotion and health in my finances. And part of that was the Dave Ramsey class helped me get through that too.
So, yeah, we'll have to turn people onto that resource. I've heard a lot of good things about that from many people. I do want to shift gears real quick. And here we are now where you're at. And I mentioned at the beginning that you're in this process of being bought out by a regional medical group. And I'd like to really hash through this conversation today, because here you're obviously in private practice. Uh-huh. And as we've been talking here, I've really been thinking about this difference between private practice and being employed by the hospitals. Uh-huh. What do you see in terms of the financial pros and cons, or time pros and cons, you know, that goes along with this decision today that many physicians struggle with?
Well, the culture of our practice, our group practice, has been around for over 80 years in the community and has been a multi-specialty practice covering family medicine, OB, pediatric surgery, and also occupational medicine, and now an emergency center, 2 emergency center sites as well. And but we've all been committed to the group, and we'll do whatever we took to, what's good for me is good for the group, what's good for the group is good for me, and so we're willing to sacrifice and share time and put out a little extra call effort and do our time at the urgency center if we have to, just to make it all work. But that's a lot of family time sacrifice, personal time sacrifice for the sake of that. And the people coming through now, as big as their debt is, realize there's other life that I have to have, and I can't always be focused on just chasing the money and paying the debt. I've got to do something else. And so the culture and expectations have shifted, and working for a hospital, working for a corporation, in some ways releases that demand, that loyalty to that degree of sacrifice, so that we can just say, I'll put in my time, I'll do what's right, I'll keep up with the kind of the mission statement and the cultural support that we can provide in medicine here, but I can say no. I'm done at 5:30. I can walk away. I don't have to keep giving more and more and more. So that's a pro in a lot of ways to free up that time. It's a con in the sense that you're not as committed because it's just I'm working for a business now that happens to own a hospital and many hospitals now, as well as many clinics. But it's going to pay the bills and stay solvent in private practice with the demands of the Affordable Care Act and the expectations of population care and data collection and much more complicated infrastructure that's necessary. There's more capital that's needed than we can generate as a private clinic. We just don't have the size, volume, and wherewithal to keep that going.
So it really sounds like you've run into a big regulatory barrier.
Mm-hmm. So we needed cash flow. We needed capital to provide those investments in not just the newest shiny thing, but the newest thing that the government requires or that practical care requires. And we just couldn't provide that and stay private.
Mm.
So we had to take who would say yes.
And so it really sounds like, I mean, even yourself having been in part of a partnership in private practice for a while, I mean, to be starting one out or joining a group, you know, that your outlook isn't too high on that right now.
Right. You know, 24 years plus here at this practice and was hoping to continue through till I could retire. And like I said, I'm kind of at the point where I can swing it until Social Security helps back me up again in another few years, but
has that affected, you know, as you make like business decisions, you know, does that affect hiring at all? You know, when you have this kind of uncertainty going on where you guys are, you know, looking to bring another physician or two on, or what's that been like?
Yeah, that's been hard. We've been trying to add some to, now we've got another deal that's certified in pain management and physiatry. And he's trying to look for a partner because he's very busy. And they're kind of, well, we heard you're kind of in negotiations, so we're not sure, because they're looking to try to make it in the private field. And that particular kind of practice, you might be able to get by with that in some environments, but overall, it's really going to be, everybody's got to be part of a big ship to make it all work. And we've been, as far as staff hiring, that hasn't been a problem, because if we're meeting the needs, everybody that's talk to us about buying us out and said we want to keep that infrastructure because you're already lean. They know, you know, if we're squeezing the pennies to get everything paid and covered, we're not bloated with staff or anything, so they're not afraid of buying us out and keeping everybody on because they know we're already running a lean machine to try to make it all work.
Interesting. So was this process, you know, do you have multiple bidders that kind of bid on the practice? Or
we had different
did you guys...
people we approached, some people that approached us, and eventually there was only one left that said we're really interested in. So it's basically we took who said yes.
Well, I got to imagine that if someone already has that infrastructure, you know, it makes it easier to apply someplace else.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Then they can... You know, there's some things that our group is doing better on community measures. There's some things they were doing better. So we've got things we can teach each other to keep everybody staying ahead and actually doing optimal care all the way around. So.
Well, as you look at the buyout, I suppose part of that is you become an employee at that point.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a trade-off there. We're no longer partners. We're no longer owners. We're just an employee. So there's rules, but they try to take care of you well enough to make you feel like you're still respected and noticed.
Well, and one of the interesting things, what brought me out to Minnesota from Seattle that I haven't talked about actually at all in the podcast, I made an acquisition that brought me from Seattle all the way out to Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
And it was certainly a huge leap of faith in doing that. And the way that it got treated as a tax deduction was really interesting. And I've actually been working on writing about that as an acquirer as you, you know, in your case, and you guys are looking at this buyout, you know, are you able to negotiate, you know, terms in terms of the taxes and the salaries afterwards? You know, how easy or hard has that been?
It was basically take the way they do it, and or don't take it at all.
Hmm.
So, but there were some areas of negotiation that we could work with as far as the transition team and support, but most of it was, here's the deal. And a lot of the financial stuff, the taxes and all that, that I didn't understand it before, I don't understand it now, so I let, again, I'm willing to let the people that know what they're talking about work that out to the best advantage of everybody, and it seems like that's going through well, but they, I don't know how much your podcast audience is, but we...
That is just amazing. Just amazing. The lawyers come out with their knives. So as we kind of wrap this up, Gary, you know, one of the things that you've referenced that I think would be great to share, I believe in just sharing resources, empowering other physicians as much as possible. You mentioned the Dave Ramsey Financial Peace course as a place, which I will link to in the show notes when we publish this on the website. What other resources do you think have really influenced you in terms of money or a mindset that you were talking about that you really had to shift?
As far as money and mindset, I'm not sure. As far as medicine, UpToDate and Medscape and the professional society seem to be really helpful. I use a lot of phone apps in the clinic. We've got one that's for hearing testing just on the fly. That's actually a dog whistle app. So you can set it for any frequency you want, and a colorblind test. Just the advice of colleagues and, you know, some of the senior colleagues has been really helpful for me. So trust the people around you and ask them. Don't, again, it gets back to don't be afraid to ask.
One of the books I read that I thought of as we were talking that I'd encourage people to check out is The Millionaire Mind.
Okay.
And I would definitely write that down if you're listening to this, everyone, because this book talks about different professions. It actually has some specific advice for doctors in it and talks about the mindset. A lot of things Gary has been talking about today, like working together as a team and some of the actions that millionaire physicians take. I think you echoed a lot of great advice there that the book would support and add on to. So I highly recommend that book to everyone. So we'll make sure to link that in the show notes as well. Well, Gary, there's only so much time we have. Do you have any closing thoughts that folks should be aware of?
One of the things I wrote down is remember that we too are human. A lot of people, we kind of forget it sometimes, but I think our patients and support staff and others in the community forget that we're human beings too. We're not just doctors. We're not just makers of a lot of money, as some people assume we are. We're people, and we have needs and feelings, and we want to work together, and we have really the same common mission if we're willing to listen to each other long enough. And remember to learn to stay balanced. Keep all the parts of your life together and ask for help. Those would be the kind of key wrap-ups I'd say.
Great. Great, 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 great. And if people have more questions, Gary, you know, how could they get in contact with you?
At St. Cloud Medical Group, I'm G. Sneed at stcloudmedical.com. That'd probably be the easiest, the email way. Then we can go from there.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Gary, again, for being with us. And if you're listening out there, I would love to tell your story. It'd be my honor to host you on the next podcast. And I know we can all learn from each other, and it can help other doctors. After all, who better to speak to physicians than another physician? I think there's some awesome stuff Gary shared with us here today. And if you'd like to be on the next podcast, make sure to contact me at dave@daviddeniston.com or on my website, www.drfreedompodcast.com. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. Thank you so much for joining us. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes or on the drfreedompodcast.com website and check in again soon. Have a good one.
Hey, this is Dave Denniston. I hope you liked today's episode. I'd love to hear your feedback. If you did like it and you want some more ideas on achieving financial freedom, visit the podcast website at www.drfreedompodcast.com. That's www.drfreedompodcast.com. And when you subscribe to my newsletter, you'll get a free copy of my ultra-popular ebook, 10 Critical Mistakes Doctors Make With Their Money. Go ahead and check out www.drfreedompodcast.com and snag a copy of your ebook now.